New Zealander Professor Alan Cooper was on the programme a little while ago talking about his findings that the kiwi is most closely related to not the moa, but the Madagascan elephant bird. Yes, and it came via Antarctica. You can hear that interview on our web page. He is founding director of Adelaide University's Australian Centre for Ancient DNA. And he's just been awarded an Australian laureate by the Research Council there, which aims to attract and retain researchers. It's worth, this laureate, $2,775,898 Australian dollars over 5 years. Professor Cooper was back in New Zealand for a Queenstown Molecular Biology Conference a week or so back, and he expanded on the laureate.
They award 15 of these a year, and they have a fixed amount of money. So I think the panels which are looking at them kind of make some arbitrary decisions based on, particularly on whether the project involves a lot of field work, which is more expensive, or more theoretical, in which case you get a lot of computers.
It is a lot of money. What are you going to do with it?
Well, in 5 years, it's quite a few positions. So I'm going to be picking up 3 postdoctoral positions and about 6 PhD students. So a large amount of the money will actually go on the salaries. But the rest of the money we'll be using for scientific research, particularly field work. We're doing quite a lot of work in the project in the outback of Australia, which is very expensive. We're working with Aboriginal communities across Australia. Travel out there is very difficult, and you have to spend a lot of time arranging to meet everybody because people are very distributed. And then we have to go back and talk about our results to the same communities. So you start putting those kind of loads together and doing a large number of community surveys. We're working on genetics out there.
What are you trying to find out?
Well, what we're doing is we're working with a very large collection of hair samples that were collected back from about 1930 through to about 1960 by a series of expeditions that went across Australia. They're called the Board of Archaeological Research, and they just went out from Adelaide on camels across Australia and sampled pretty much everybody they met. Now, the interesting thing was it was done relatively well for the time. It was all with permission, and many places they didn't get any samples because the Aboriginal groups said, no, we're not interested. And they collected an enormous amount of information around the individual. So there's
what was their thinking at the time?
Well, the thinking at the time was that the Aboriginal groups were disappearing. They would not survive into the modern era, which back in the time was what people were thinking about Indigenous groups, that they would all be modernised and all that culture would be lost. And it was an amazing guy called Norman Tyndale, who was an entomologist at the South Australian Museum, who led this, who eventually ended up as a World War II spy master. Amazing guy, very interesting. But he recorded everything. They took film footage, they did audio recordings, and they asked the individuals to draw their song lines and their maps and their genealogies and their mother's language, where they came from. The material behind each one of these samples is probably the best anthropological collection I've seen in the world. And more importantly, I think it's probably the only resource left that you could reconstruct Australia before Europe. And this is the thing that I find so surprising. Coming from New Zealand to Australia, you know, we take great pride in our Maori ancestry and the origins of New Zealand. You get to Australia, and they've got 50,000 years of Aboriginal occupation of Australia. That's the longest continuous occupation by any one culture, if you like, anywhere in the world. It goes through the last glacial maximum, major climate changes, and they know nothing about it. Nothing, nada. And it's not so much that they don't know anything about that history. There's the traditional Aboriginal Dreamtime stories, but other than that, nothing is known. It's the fact that they don't worry that they don't know. That's the bit that I find so strange about Australia, is to come there and say, yeah, we've got 50,000 years of history we know nothing about, and we don't really care too much. You know, we've got 150
years. So it took
years.
A New Zealander to come up with this
well,
concept.
Well, I don't remind them of that too often, uh-huh, because they're very sensitive on that front. But yes, I think it's to see how in New Zealand it's become so important to everything that we understand about how New Zealand is made, and to see that missing from Australia. That was one of the things that drove me to do the project in the first place. So when I came across this enormous collection of hair samples in the museum in South Australia, I recognised instantly this is probably the only resource left in the world that you could use anywhere to reconstruct the indigenous map, if you like, of Australia.
So you can still get DNA samples from those hairs?
Exactly. So what we do is we analyse a small number of the hair samples, and we can get mitochondrial DNA, which measures the maternal lineages, which are often the most important in many of these groups. And even if
are you confident the DNA is still intact?
Yeah, we've already done trials, and so we had 100% success rate, and I think we did about 50 specimens.
Because you don't, I mean, they would have been treated fairly roughly, I imagine.
They were. They were dried out in the desert when they were taken, and that actually is probably not the probably one of the best things to do, because by taking the moisture out of the sample, you stop it degrading. If you keep it in a plastic bag or something, it'd probably be worse. So they just put it in paper envelopes. They often took blood stains if the individual was actually that happy about it. But the records to see these individuals, the actual video footage, and, you know, as recordings of the songs and the dances and stuff, just remarkable what the foresight of these early archaeologists to go out and say this stuff is incredibly important and is going to disappear. Now, they're right about that bit. A lot of the culture has disappeared. And so to see this recorded, and particularly the Europeans, of course, forced many of the Aboriginal groups off their traditional lands, almost all of them, and put them into camps or little
reservations.
Centers. Yeah, reservations, effectively. And so as a result, all of the original distribution and the diversity, a lot of the culture was lost at that point. And so in a way, one of the things we're hoping to do with this is by creating a map of Indigenous Australia at or just after European colonisation, is to work out where all the genetic diversity was distributed such that people today that have Indigenous ancestry and no idea about their heritage, and that includes all of the stolen generation, of course, because often the records are deliberately lost or not provided such that that those children, when they grow up, have no idea about family relationships or where they come from. And as a result, at the moment, there's very little opportunity for you to retrace. Australia's a big place, and trying to find anything out in terms of that heritage is difficult. But with this genetic map, and this is what many of the communities are actually so happy about when we explain
they are
what
happy.
We're going to do. Yeah, they say, if we can help, people actually connect. And often they're very interested to find out their own family relationships and how the different communities are related, and we think we're related to them. And what's interesting is to turn up, and we spend 4 or 5 days in the community and basically say, what would you like to know? These records exist, and we can get you copies of all the art and everything about your ancestry, everything you're interested in. But what are you interested in from a genetic perspective? Because these are the things we could do if you're interested. And that is really interesting, because I think it's like the first time that scientists have turned up and sat down and said, well, what do you want? As opposed to, we're doing a medical survey and we need samples, or, you know, much more dictatorial. And so it's really interesting to spend time talking to individuals about what's important to them in terms of family relationships and community.
You're also talking about doing study on the human microbiomes?
Yes, so that's a related study.
Is it all related?
It's all related, effectively. We're looking at human movement around the world, and the impacts of colonisation on Indigenous communities in particular. And the second part, that impact on how Indigenous groups are changed, particularly in terms of health and diseases, comes down to the microbiome. Now, the microbiome is the term we give all the bacteria that come along with us.
Very complicated ecosystem.
Huge. We are, and this is exactly right. We are ecosystems.
What's the stat? Like
90%. 90% of your cells are not you. They're bacterial. And they play an enormous role. I mean, modern medicine is finally getting around to actually working out that a very large part of your function, health, mood, depression, anxiety, everything else, is your bacteria, which has been totally ignored and generally nuked with antibiotics whenever given half a chance. Now, increasingly, we're finding that modern Western diseases are associated with those bacteria, things like diabetes, obesity, autism, all have components with that bacterial diversity. Peanut allergies, there was a nice paper out yesterday showing that they could fix peanut allergies by putting a bacteria back into mice and changing the gut porosity. It's an inflammation that's happening along the gut, which increases porosity, and the peanut bits are getting into your blood, which then causes the reactions. And they showed in a beautiful mouse model that they'd given this allergy by giving them antibiotics, that the porosity reduces right up by putting one particular bacteria back in. Basically, the bacteria are very good at modulating the immune system. They have to live there, and they don't want the immune system going ballistic. So they actually modulate it. And similarly with the depression and anxiety, many of the gram-positive bacteria in your gut can secrete serotonin, which they don't use at all, but make us feel great. And they're actually manipulating your feelings, your health and everything else.
That's
because
terrifying.
It's their environment too. And
no, but it's terrifying how easily you can mess up with that.
Yes, exactly.
So and never get it back again.
Exactly. You're coming along and putting antibiotics on top and wondering why you feel like rubbish for the rest of the time. Well, you're an ecosystem, and what you're doing is like spraying Roundup on a grass lawn and then being surprised that broadleaf weeds take over and you never get the grass back ever again. I mean, these are stable ecosystems, and once they're set to a new position, getting them back to where you want to be is a very, very difficult job indeed.
You're going way beyond your field, aren't
yes,
you?
Yes, exactly.
You know,
yes, yes.
I mean, there's biology and cultural history and it's all over the show.
It is all over the show, yes. But one advantage we've got, the reason that we're doing that microbiome work is that we've discovered, bizarrely enough, that the calcified plaque on your teeth, the tartar that you see on the television adverts, that the dentist removes, all that annoying sonicating thing that really shakes, they do that because there's no way you can brush off the plaque once it becomes calcified. It's absolutely cemented on there, and you can't remove it any other way than with a mechanical device. And that's what the dentist does. Now, it turns out that that's actually really good for us because the calcified bacteria, particularly on old skeletons, preserve all of the microbiome in the mouth of that individual. So we're running around the world sampling from museums and archaeological collections. It's called dental calculus is the technical name, but it's big deposits of tartar on the teeth. We scrape it off, and small bits like a 2 or 3 millimeter chunk, and then we take it back to the lab and we extract all the bacterial DNA from it. And from that, we can work out whether they have TB, what they're eating, their health. And so we can follow all the way...
So what's the connection between the bacteria, the plaque on the teeth, and the gut, which is the
yes.
important bit, presumably?
Well, and the latter bit there is the key. Much of the work we've done so far on health has concerned the gut. And the mouth has been overlooked. And I think this is a huge problem. I think that the gut is important. Everyone loves the gut. But the mouth is an incredibly important part of that because that's where you're taking in pathogens and you're taking in food and you're doing the whole processing. And we have, I think our evidence, by looking at how the dental calculus, the bacteria, and it changes through time when you go from Neanderthals to early hunter-gatherers to farmers, which is when it goes all wrong because we eat carbohydrate and sugar and we stuffed it up completely.
Agriculture was the terrible thing,
wasn't
it? It
was a backward step. It was a really backward
step. And
we
all suffered.
Yes, and we still do.
Health, you know, stature, everything.
Exactly, and it's a grind. Suddenly you get social structures, you get chiefs, you get slaves, you get all that hierarchy, you get the, you know, much more of the warfare going on.
Which makes it all the more interesting why it ever took on, you know, evolutionarily.
Evolutionarily, there's so many of you. So the hunter-gatherers are tall, they're good-looking, they're strong, they're happy, but you outbreed them. The farmers, these horrible little dwarfy people that come in, they're full of diseases and they're just disgusting, but they breed like flies because they've got so many carbohydrates because of the crops, because of the wheat and the barley. And in evolutionary terms, if you outbreed your neighbour, no matter what they look like, you win. And that's effectively what happens. Hunter-gatherers get pushed out by farmers putting up fences, taking over land and just spreading and spreading. And the poor old noble savages are pushed out to
so
the back.
So it actually lends a whole new complexion to the survival of the fittest.
Yes.
Because
yes,
they weren't
exactly. No, depends on your criteria.
Yeah,
And under evolutionary terms, breeding more generally comes down as being more fit
yeah.
than actually being stronger, in human terms anyway. Anyway, so what we've done with the dental calculus is we've shown how those diseases have changed through time, and particularly it all went badly wrong once we started eating carbohydrates and then very badly wrong once we started having enormous amounts of processed flour and sugar during
you're
the industrial
revolution.
You're
going to tell me about the paleo diet anytime soon, aren't
well,
you?
Well, the paleo diet's, I think, far too heavy on the proteins. They forget that back in those days you didn't actually get that much meat. There was bits of it, but you're eating more insect grubs and little bits of honey and little bits of grain. It was very scavengy, whereas the paleo diet is so heavy on the proteins. I agree that the carbohydrates we have far too much, but going that extreme on the proteins is maybe not really all that much better either. And it would be an interesting experiment on that. And finally, people are starting to do those experiments on mice, but you wouldn't believe that that hasn't happened so far, that we don't actually know what happens when you feed a whole bunch of protein or a whole bunch of carbohydrate to individuals.
Don't we?
No, it was never done. It turns out it's all to do with Nixon. So Nixon, a lot of stuff is to do with Nixon. But Nixon, back in the 60s, so I've read, was handed the Midwest vote for Republicans if he subsidized sugar. That was back in the sugar days. And it was the high corn syrup, the fructose, which you find everywhere. And at the time, they knew something had gone badly wrong with the diets because everyone was having heart attacks and whatever. And they knew it was either fat or sugar. And there were two lobbies. Oh, actually, there's one lobby, which is the sugar lobby. The fat lobby didn't have a lobby. And basically, the Midwest was handed Nixon on a plate if he subsidized sugar and went for producing alcohol and the whole bit. And so fat got the blame. So fat in the 60s was targeted as number one enemy for, heart attacks and obesity and everything else like that. And only now we're starting to work out that sugar is probably as big, if not bigger, a component. And yet we're pumping it into our children with every piece of junk food But that lobby was so effective at, you know, it's not sugar, it's look over there, look at the fat bit. Anyway, so what we're doing is using the teeth to work out how those bacteria have changed and what the impacts are from it in terms of our health. And the thing that I think people have missed is that the dentists do your mouth and the doctors do everything else, and never the two shall meet. There's a lot of, like, professional pride. Doctor will never go into someone's mouth, and a dentist will never go outside someone's mouth. And what we've done is, by putting a whole bunch of messy carbohydrate into our mouths all the time, the bread and the flour, is we've set up this kind of paste around the bottom of your teeth. That's the kind of mush you get after eating a cake or a biscuit. And that's perfect bacterial food. And the bacteria are loving this and they're eating it. And as a result, we have a permanent infection along our gums. And this is why when you go to a dentist and they do the cleaning, most people will bleed. Now, you shouldn't bleed. That should never happen. That's only happening because you have an infection of this mush. And what it's doing is it's causing inflammation along the bottom of your gums. And that allows things in your mouth to leak down into your bloodstream. Okay, it forms a contact. And so as a result, the bacteria in your mouth are now turning up in, well, they have been for a while, but we're starting to work out that they're in the atherosclerotic plaques. That's actually gingivalis, the one along your gum line. They're in your heart muscle, so Streptococcus mutans, which causes the holes in your teeth, the one that bores, it binds to collagen very well. And so it gets into the blood, wanders around the body, and ends up on your heart valves and in the heart muscle itself. We're finding the oral bacteria all over the body in places it should never get to, because we've created this massive infection in our mouths, which was never there. That was never part. You go back and look at the hunter-gatherers or the Neanderthals. Their teeth are fantastic.
Having said that, how old were they when they died?
Well, there's a bit of a misconception there, I think, about how young many of these hunter-gatherers died. They had a more of a splayed-out distribution, so a lot of them died young, but the ones that did get old seemed to get quite old. There's many Neanderthals or early hunter-gatherers that have got broken legs and stuff that have been looked after. They live quite long times. The problem is they don't live and die in big cemeteries, so you don't have large surveys. And so I think, yes, they probably died younger than we do today, but hell, the farmers died very young. They were even worse, because they come in, they've got lots of carbohydrates, but they're living in these big unsanitary groups. They have to look after the crops. So you've got all the tuberculosis and the viruses coming in. They've got bad nutrition. The crop fails. They've got nothing else to do, so the whole lot die. And you see massive signs of nutritional stress in the skeletons. They were dying way younger than the hunter-gatherers were. And it's really only, I think, in the last 100 years or so, antibiotics and the like, that you've started to recover the much healthier lifespan. Certainly it's only the last, I think it was 1890, we got back to the height, the average height that we had as hunter-gatherers. So the body stature and the health dropped off all through that time until you got the industrial food being produced.
I'm talking to Professor Alan Cooper, who's the founding director of Adelaide University's Australian Centre for Ancient DNA. Your research into the microbiomes is likely to, once more, suggests that the modern living is bad for us.
Yeah, which is not to say we should stop doing it, but we should modify how we're doing it. We should recognise that, for example, giving antibiotics to kids at a young age is probably a very detrimental thing. And there's these ear infections, which are rapidly treated with massive antibiotic treatments at a very early age, are now being strongly associated with changing the gut flora permanently, and as a result, having big impacts on things like autism, for example, and levels of depression, Crohn's and the like. Because in many of these situations, they're in ecology. And once you've blasted it, it doesn't necessarily recover back to the way that it was going to be.
Given the desperation to find the cause of autism, I'm a bit worried that we are now saying that it might be antibiotics.
It contributes. I think autism obviously has got many different causes, but they seem to be honing in on the fact that autistic children definitely have a different gut biota to other children, and they're not eating things necessarily that different. So clearly there's something going on in the gut. And they've worked out that the brain, for example, is actually significantly an immune organ. You don't think of it as such. You think of it as purely neural. But a very large part of the cells in the brain are actually immune cells, and they're there for health and the like, and they've been modified. But as a result, it's plumbed in to your whole immune system. So if your gut is going off, particularly as a young child, because you're being challenged by these allergens, because your bacterial diversity has dropped away and suddenly food is coming into contact with your intestinal wall, it should always be passaged through a bacterial medium. They're responsible for breaking the food down and then giving it to you in the form you can deal with. If that has been broken down, and if the allergens are interacting and suddenly there's inflammation signals going off, well, that's a very much an immune response. And all the immune parts of the body are responding to those hormones and signals. And so certainly in the States at the moment, there's a significant thought that a big component, or at least a significant component of autism, may well be that brief period of time when synapses are being formed at a certain stage in the development of the child's head, that immune responses going off in the intestines are actually influencing neural connections and actually interfering with them. And it's probably a very small, crucial window. And as you say, autism is such a big thing, and there will be many ways that you can do this. You can cause interference in that pattern. The gut will be only one of them. But nevertheless, it's one that we are interfering with very much, and we can now see why something in your gut is actually going to interfere with the way in which neural connections are being made in your brain.
Is the human now your focus? I mean, you've spent your career investigating old animals, right?
Yes, yes.
Are you veering away from that now?
Diversifying, I hope. So we're still doing work on the megafauna, on climate change and the like, which I find really interesting. And the laureate, actually, I managed to kind of combine all these things. So the study is how humans have moved around the world and particularly how their microbiome has changed and influence this, perhaps, in the way that Indigenous peoples are hit very hard by the effects of colonisation, maybe due to that microbiome changing, the Europeans bringing in very different bacteria. But I've also included in there the megafaunal work I've been doing in the Northern Hemisphere. Bison and horses, as a way of actually seeing, okay, how is climate change impacting things at the same time? Because these events, human movement and the microbiome, are not in a vacuum. They're as part of that whole environmental change which is going on at the same time. And the animals, the megafauna that we're working on, is a really good model to understand, okay, when are big changes happening and what are the changes that are going on? And that work is really showing us that these rapid warming events that happen throughout the Ice Age seem to be the ones which are causing the big death and destruction phases. And we're starting to really get a much better handle on why these populations through time are turning over and being replaced. You know, there's a big debate, for example, the role of humans in terms of killing everything and the role of climate in terms of doing it. And, you know, you come from New Zealand, there's moa bones all along the beaches. It's very clear that humans killed the megafauna. There's no debate about it. And yet you go to the Northern Hemisphere, the situation's nowhere near as clear, because as far the human groups that come into these populations are small. They don't have horses. You can't chase them. They don't have bows and arrows. They're using only spears at the time. And the population sizes of the things like the bison and the mammoth are in the, you know, hundreds of millions. These are enormous populations. They go right the way across into Russia. And so how these small human groups are meant to kill all of them is very difficult, because you don't find bones with human marks. I mean, that occurs later on in the Holocene.
But so you're saying climate change.
And what we've done is, by following climate change back over the last 50,000 years and using the DNA from these bones and carbon dating them, we can actually see the populations themselves going up and down dramatically long before humans are on the landscape, in response to, as it turns out, these rapid warming events. That seems to be the kicker. And these are very rapid. When I say rapid, we're talking 50 years or less, and you're getting changes of 10 degrees C, you know, big changes on the environment. I'm not sure whether it's warming per se which is doing it, or the fact that when the warming events occur, that is the biggest single change you'll get anywhere in the last 2 million years.
Is the correlation between that rapid warming and CO2 in the atmosphere?
The CO2 does follows along a much more plateaued out version. It's not nearly as sensitive, seemingly. It does respond, but it responds over a longer time frame. So, for example, as you come out of the last glacial maximum, when the glaciers are the biggest, about 18,000 years ago, the CO2 starts warming up from about 16,000 years and keeps warming right the way up.
Cause or consequence or correlation?
Well, yes, that's the thing. Correlation, definitely. I suspect it's not cause, although that is a possibility, but it does track very nicely what's going on. So you can see how the CO2 has changed. And, of course, the levels that we're now at, you know, 400 parts per million versus what we're talking back then. I mean, I love showing these slides when I'm giving these talks, because the CO2 is going dong, 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 and then boing, off the graph. That's us. We're so far off the plot that...
So people saying, look, this has always happened, up and down temperature.
It's a question of scale.
You're saying...
Yeah, certainly the last 2 million years, which is the Pleistocene, the CO2 has never got anywhere near this, not even near it. It's down about 1/10 to 1/20 of what we're talking now. And CO2 is a known global warming gas. You can't put that much CO2 in the atmosphere and not warm it. I mean, if you could show how you could do that, you'd get a Nobel Prize. If you could show that I can put a whole bunch of CO2 into something and not warm something up as a greenhouse gas, that's the problem. You know, they can say it's not happening. The CO2 is there. We know CO2 traps and works as a greenhouse gas. If you can square that circle, that is not happening, you're brilliant, and you would get a Nobel Prize.
So is that the bias on the climate change? Is that why you were down the natural trap cave in Wyoming?
Yes. So I've been working up in the Yukon and Alaska in the permafrost for many years, digging up frozen bones, and was carrying on that
I work. Saw a YouTube clip of you in the permafrost. Miners have been exposing the bones.
Yes.
And it didn't look that frozen.
No, we only go in summer, and for about 2 months of the year, it's actually quite nice up on the surface.
But doesn't it get unfrozen?
Just the surface, just like a couple of inches.
And that's all right?
And that's all right. And what we're doing with the miners, they're moving the edge of the hills back so fast that the bit that was just melting is rapidly removed because they're eating into the frozen dirt and ice to get at the gold. So we're basically following them around as they expose these frozen bones, which is very nice of them. And they're great. They're keen to find out what the bones are, and they're totally interested in, you know, what's that and how does it work. They're great guys, really. Look, quite a few Kiwis, actually, up there doing it as well. They do some of the winter thing. So we're carrying on that work because that's great for trying to work out how the populations have changed in response to climate. But we've just opened up a new area in Wyoming, which is right up the north of the 48 states, on the border, almost on the border with Canada. Montana's in the way, but there's a big cave there that was found many years ago and explored back in the 70s, and they found hundreds of thousands of bones. It's a 100-foot drop, and it's got a small entrance about 10 meters wide. And it's beautifully concealed. I've done a lot of caving in my life, and I've never seen one quite like this. You're just walking across a slab of limestone, looking down a ridge over a lake, and suddenly it just goes whoop, and all the sides shoot in.
So all these animals have fallen into
it? Straight down. And a 100-foot drop, bam, at the bottom, and it's just a huge pile of rock and animal bones. Because it's not permafrost, because you don't get frozen deposits in the 48 states and southern Canada, it's very hard to find these large collections of bones that have DNA in them. And this cave is high enough up in the mountains that most of the year it's got snow plugged in the surface. And it's about 5 degrees centigrade on the ground. And so as a result, the bones have been preserved really well. And it's actually a very unique
Didn't they
situation.
Get all wet and soggy?
No, a little bit damp, but nowhere near like New Zealand caves where it rains all the time. It must be a little bit drier up there for most of the year round. I think when it does snow, it locks all the water up in the snow.
And did you find bones of things you've never heard of, didn't
yes.
know about?
Well, yes. Yeah. So because it's a different ecosystem down there in the lower 48 states, then compared to up in the Yukon, we find things that we don't normally come across. So one of the first bones we found when we're down there was a beautifully big bone about 40 centimetres long of a camel tibia, which is a lovely, great, you know, you don't often see camels up in the Yukon.
When you saw it, did you go, there's a camel tibia?
No, I think we're going to put a video up of it because it's quite funny, because I found the end of it just sticking out of the wall. We're talking and someone said, oh, isn't that a bone? And I said, oh yeah, it's a bison. And I started digging back into the wall because it was end on, and dug back about 3 or 4 inches, and yeah, it's a bison. And then after about 6 inches, no, it must be a horse because it's too long. And then after about 9 inches, it was like, okay, it's not a horse either. It must be something else. And finally bring it out. And then the camel, the toes are quite distinctive. They're split. And so it was pulling it out. It's like, oh, my God, it's a camel. And perfect. You know, it was one of the first bones we found. Beautiful. The cave has got cheetah, American cheetah. They had a completely independent derived cheetah. It's actually a puma, which is, you know, the mountain lion. And it had, on steroids, it had just become so completely close to a cheetah, you know, the big air scoop nose, the big domed head like a V8 engine, and the hyper bendable spine so that the rear legs can come right in front of the front legs so it can go hyper fast, completely convergent such that the paleontologists were sure it was an African cheetah, and yet it was a puma. Had worked out exactly the same tricks we know it was even faster than the African cheetah, even though it's extinct, went extinct with all the other megafauna about 10,000 years ago, because there's a little animal still in the area called a pronghorn, which looks like a little antelope. It looks completely out of place because you're in North America and you've got this little antelope running around. It's not a true antelope. And it's faster than any of the little antelopes in South Africa, faster than springboks and everything else. It can do something like 60 miles per hour, I think. So enormous speeds. And there's nothing in North America apart from people on four-wheel drives with guns that could go anywhere near that speed. So clearly it had evolved to outrun something which is no longer there. And so the cheetah is the only animal. So we know not only did they come up with a new cheetah, it was actually faster than the African cheetah. And you had lions, great big American lions. They're about 20% bigger than the current ones. Huge things. And so we were finding the big
and these teeth. Things became extinct because of climate change?
Climate change plus humans turn up right at the end. I think humans apply the coup de grace, But the populations have become small enough and fragmented by the climate change such that the humans could do it. And that's always been the mystery. How could such a small number of humans kill such a large number of animals? Well, it wasn't such a large number of animals at the time.
Well, you know, people have been talking about the passenger pigeon and how, when the air was black for days, the passenger pigeon, how could people have killed it? Well, they did.
Yeah, true. But that was with shotguns and really impressive shotguns. Like, I've seen some of them in museums where they welded four shotguns together. And it was like an eight-barreled thing, which they then fired from a stick to try and knock these things down for fun, actually. And, I mean, the reason that that population got knocked off might be something to do with the other megafauna in that it had a breeding structure that required that number of birds to actually work for its breeding. I don't know how it worked, but it did. They have quite a lot of investigations on how this happens. And so if you have a very large population, it might actually get to the stage it requires a large number of individuals to have any breeding happen at all, competitive and the like. And so
you're suggesting it was like a beehive?
Almost, yeah, or some sort of organised social structure.
So you need a critical mass.
Exactly. Ah. You need a quorum before it even starts, kind of thing.
I'm talking to Professor Alan Cooper, who's head of Adelaide University's Australian Centre for Ancient DNA. What were stilt-legged horses?
Oh, they were very interesting little things. They were a completely independent horse, yet again, like the cheetah, another thing that had been invented in North America. You tend to forget, North America is where the camel evolved. It's where horses evolved. We think it's where bears evolved. A whole bunch of the animals, you tend to think, you know, camels are now only in the Middle East and South America. And yet, North America was their homeland. Horses, similarly, evolved in North America, then went extinct, which is the irony, survived in the Old World. The Spanish bring them back. And suddenly horses take off. You know, wild horses in America do very well. And the interesting question is, well, why did you go extinct in the first place if you can come back and do it now? And, you know, clearly there's some combination of that human climate change thing that when humans are really focusing on megafauna, that's all they did, that drives something out. Whereas you bring horses back in later on, even with a bit of hunting, if we're farming, if we're doing other things, suddenly the pressure is so much less that an animal which is adapted to that environment can survive. It all depends on the what's happening at the time. So the stilt-legged horse was a little thing like an ass, which always makes everyone laugh, which are these small donkey-like creatures that live in Central Asia. And they're stilt-legged because they live on hard, stony ground. And when you live on hard, stony ground and you're going to walk across it for a long or run across it for a long way, it's good to have your legs having no mass, to have little sticks so you kind of bounce across the landscape. Energy efficient. You don't want to be carrying large amounts of mass in your legs. And so on hard ground, horses always tend to make these little stick-like legs. And so you can tell instantly that the stilt-legged horse, and they need a better name than that, but that's the one they've still got for in North America, they had thought it was one of these Asian asses that had come across and just lived in North America, same as the cheetah and same as everything else. What we're finding is it's independent evolution each time. Again, it was a completely independent group that had come up with the same strategy for dealing with hard ground and moving across large spaces to get water and food. And so they're the size of a donkey, little stick-like things without the big barrel tummies. And yes, the cave is full of all sorts of different horses, many different species. And so the whole question about how horses are evolving, we're going to tackle using the material in that cave. So we'll go back there for the next 2 years. We've got funding.
Can anybody go there?
No, the cave is locked off. Once they worked out in the 70s,
no, but obviously not your average layperson. But I mean, you need to put in a proper scientific proposal.
Exactly. We're going to go down. And the reason that they opened the cave up again for us was specifically because we said we can do DNA. That was never done previously. Back in the 70s, they just went out and collected things. They then put them in a museum in Kansas. And didn't keep it air-conditioned, so every summer it gets really, really hot.
So all the DNA and the stuff that's been taken out is already too degraded?
It's still there, but it's not in fantastic nick. And what we're doing now, the ancient DNA field, like the medical field, is moving much more towards the point where we're trying to do whole genomes, rather than just little bits of mitochondrial DNA, which is the maternal line of things, and is useful for working out how populations have moved around, how they're related, but doesn't really give you access to all the genes responsible for metabolism and behavior and, you know, the interesting bits, the nuclear genome, which is the far more complicated package of genetic information. And up until recently, the technology has been such that it was very difficult to access that. But now, with this what we call next-generation sequencing, which is what people are using to sequence genomes of humans, for example, or medical work for cancer, that is now available such that we're applying it to these ancient specimens and we're getting whole genomes out of these animals. We've got no one to analyze them. That's the big joke, of course. We can get all this information out, but our biology students are still coming through not being able to handle computer programming and big data. And this is what I'm telling schools now when, you know, we're putting these videos out of the caves and stuff to get school kids interested, and they love it. And you go out there and how can we do this? And it's like, you know, science is great. You should really do it. It's huge. Climate change, such a big problem. But if you're going to do biology, do computing now, because it's all big data. Whether you're measuring whales migrating through the sea or birds flying, the ability to measure data about how things work has gone exponentially nuts.
Can you do that?
No. So I'm trying to work out if I can get through to retirement without learning how to do programming.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have to hire people
that
can do programming.
Lots of helpers.
Exactly.
Are you finding human bones in the natural trap cave?
No, not so far. And that'll be a problem if we do, because the North American, there's a policy. Yeah, NAGPRA.
Oh, I see. You can't...
Suddenly would shut down the cave.
Right.
We'd have to get a whole bunch of consultation.
But there's no reason why there wouldn't be.
No, I think probably they were smart enough not to fall in, and it's a very isolated position. It's way up on a ridge on the edge of a mountain. So far there's been no sign. And we're keeping an eye out, and we have to really watch for that kind of stuff.
You might have to keep it quiet if you find it.
No, we've got the BLM monitoring things. The Bureau of Land Management, that's the American land agency. It's kind of like our DOC, is there monitoring stuff to make sure, A, that we're safe. Because I was the one in charge of putting all the ropes down, which is kind of funny, because I did all the caving, right? So I turn up there, and you've got 10 American paleontologists, and they can't tie a knot. You know, you're like, oh, my God, all right. Well, so I'm using all the New Zealand do-it-yourself technology, you know, to rig the ropes, to put the safety lines on, to get these guys down. Getting people down a rope
is easy.
They'll
think you're Indiana Jones.
Well, no, but they do what you say. They're so safety conscious. If you say, you have to do this, the safety, it's like, oh, okay, well, no questioning there.
You've just been in Queenstown, a molecular biology conference. Mm. Speaking, I take it.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
As you do.
Unstoppable.
There is a certain brain drain from New Zealand to Australia. I know that you've got other New Zealanders at
yes.
your centre in Adelaide.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And given the amount of money you've got washing around, I'm not surprised. Mm, Did you get a sense of what's happening here?
Yes, it's a bit worrying to come back to New Zealand after, you know, I think it's 10 years or so since I really looked in at the science situation. And what I feel from an outsider's perspective is that it seems to have gone horribly wrong. And it's corporate. It's become all managerial and it's almost like groupthink. There's these government-led targets that you're all going to work towards and little small teams. And it's like George Orwell has taken over, you know, in terms of the phrasing and the mindset and the way things are being talked about.
The mindset here is getting bang for the buck. We're a small country. We can't afford to mess around.
Mm.
We need to focus. And I suppose that's
I think that's what's
the
behind
instinct.
It. And I think
yes.
it came out of the CRIs, that whole logic about the CRIs. Unfortunately, that seems to have spread like a cancer across all of science. So now everybody's doing it. And the trouble is, I don't think you do get a bang for a buck that way. In fact, surveys in America show that you don't, actually. So the Americans did this a while back. They decided they're going to put money into big science and big teams and answer big questions. And a whole bunch of the small people who weren't involved said, well, hold on, let's do some surveys on whether that works, whether you actually get research outcomes that would justify funding in that way. And they showed very effectively that it didn't necessarily. In certain areas, astronomy, for example, where you're going to have to build a radio telescope and it's going to be enormous, you need those big teams because no one can afford it. That's true. But they showed that the what we call investigator-led, I think is the term in New Zealand these days, someone having ideas and saying, I've got an idea, I'm going to pitch it to the government and get a grant and do the work and find something amazing. Darwin is an example. You know, the kind of completely idiosyncratic, challenging everything that we know type idea.
But instead of that here, we've got people trying to fit themselves
exactly.
into what's being asked of them.
If that's not part of the team, if it's high risk, it's not going to go anywhere because that's, you know, we've got KPIs. We're going to have to do, we have to justify every minute of what we're doing. And, you know, it's groupthink. It's like, you know, if we all work on this and we all think the same way, it must be true. And I think when I left New Zealand, and what I think New Zealand's always been good at, is that kind of idiosyncratic or iconoclast. You know, I'm going to think completely different. I'm going to make it. I'm going to make it out of wire and pieces of cardboard. I'm going to be cutting edge with the rest of the world, but I'm going to make it out of an old washing machine or whatever. You know, that kind of can-do character, the farming type thing. That was where we were when we left. We could do anything. You could be cutting edge. And I come back now and I look at, for example, the next generation sequencing, this new era of genomics. And New Zealand looks to me to be 10, 15 years behind, or 10 years at least, and the field is changing so fast. And I don't know, to me it strikes me that you're right, it's a small country and you've got a small amount of money. But that doesn't mean to say you've got to put it all into these centres and drown them in paperwork and management, because that's where I think you're losing your money, is on the administrators and the director and the assistant director and the assistant director's PA. That's where the money is being locked up. It's not getting to the people that are doing the science. It's this trying to fit corporatization into science. I don't think... It has its place in certain areas, but when you let it run as wildly as it seems to have run here, I think you lose the power of the individual saying, I think you're all wrong, and I think I'm going to show you you're wrong using X or Y. And you need to balance it. You need to have both. And to me, looking from the outside, it looks like New Zealand has gone way, way too much on the managerial group-led thing, which I think is going to kill all your early career researchers, because they're the ones that can't survive in that environment.
Are you getting a sense that New Zealand scientists feel the same way?
Yeah, I've kind of asked around at the conference, and there was a lot of head nodding. We've gone a little bit far here. We're all buying into this because that's where the funding comes from. So if you don't, you're out of luck. So people are being complicit in saying the words and reiterating the values. And talking to the ECRs, you know, there's not a lot of positions being created. Those centres are filled up. You've got your senior scientist in there, and many of them cutting back on their postdoc positions because the funding, you know, they have to go out and find their funding to operate. And as a result, what we call early career researchers or early ECRs, they're the ones I'm really worrying about. They're the ones that are leaving because they're not seeing the career development.
You're not here on a recruitment drive.
I totally. I've got 6 postdocs and 6 PhDs. So, yeah, come on over to Australia.
What's Australia doing that's so much better?
Well, certainly you're right that they do have a much bigger population base and therefore, as a result, can spend more money on science. So they've got more room to move in that way. But they don't seem to have bought into the Crown Research Institute model. You know, with the CSIRO, which is our version of what DSIR was and now the CRIs, they're still there, but it's widely looked down on as not a good place to go and do science. They have some good stuff. They invented Wi-Fi, for example, you know, and they have their role, definitely. But there's still much more of the UK or the American system where the money is far more distributed to individual researchers that can demonstrate, they can form small teams, but they can demonstrate clever ideas and that they have got great productivity. They can do things. They've done things before. And that's why I'm getting the laureate. You know, I've done enough in terms of getting high-profile publications and reasonably major findings that they're saying, yeah, okay, you say you can do this. That's your track record. Go to it. Knock yourself out. And we'll come back in 5 years and we'll want to see exactly what you've done. But not the kind of filling out timesheets and justifying every hour of the week in terms of who your end user is. And that's the kind of language I'm hearing here all the time, which scares the hell out of me.
Where are you going next? What are you going to do next?
Antarctica. Actually, which wasn't in the grant, so I'm going to have to try and finagle that one. But again, that's the advantage of the Australian system to a degree.
You can break all the rules.
Well, there's a bit more room to manoeuvre. And, you know, many Australian scientists, if anyone is listening, they'd probably be disagreeing violently. They actually think they've got too many restrictions on them. But boy, compared to what New Zealand guys are like, I think we've got it very, very well situated. So what we're going to do is I'm working with the same guy that got stuck on the ship last year. You know Chris Turney? He's a lovely guy. We do a lot of work. He's a very good climate change scientist. And so we're going down with him to a place in Antarctica where he has found that air movement from mountains has basically removed the top of some glaciers. We call it ablation, where air is moving fast enough to make the ice disappear, come straight into to gas. And as a result, the glacier, which is flowing down the mountain, has actually started to expose all of the different layers of the glacier. Instead of downwards, from top to bottom, as you might imagine, the movement of the air has actually caused the glacier to respond by growing upwards. So all the different layers of the glacier are suddenly laid out from left to right in front of you on the surface. So by standing on a mountain looking down at the glacier, you're looking at the top being back about 50,000 years and the bottom about 5,000 years. So all the time is laid out. And for example, right across the middle of the glacier is this huge black dirty band, which is the last glacial maximum. So when the world was coldest, it was very dry and there's a lot of dust blowing around as a result. And all the dust was in the atmosphere. That's what you're seeing across the middle of the glacier. So you've actually got time laid out. And so what we're doing is we're going to take samples all the way down this glacier, which is samples through time, big samples, like we're using a chainsaw and I'm cutting out big meter chunks. And I'm melting all the ice down there. I've designed all these little plastic socks to hang up on the wall. And we're going to melt all the ice through the sock. And it's got a little filter at the bottom of it. So I'm catching all the microorganisms that have been stuck in the ice. They're from the sea around Antarctica, which have blown onto the ice. And so we're going to use that to work out how the currents around Antarctica, which totally influence global climate, have changed. Particularly, we're getting very excited now. We're working with a guy from Victoria, actually. We've found science works in mysterious ways, and I apologise if I'm all over the place here, but we decided that people trying to drill into the lakes down in Antarctica to look at the ancient ice, a guy from New Zealand contacted us and said, do you know that those lakes, when they retreat with the glaciers, little stalactite things drop out from underneath them because the bottom of the lake has got saturated calcium in it from all the ground-up rock, and the calcium precipitates. So when the glacier goes away, these little stalactites drop out. And I've always thought that stalactites should have DNA in them, because the bacteria are involved in how the calcium is secreted. So I said, great, send us some. And so we started analysing their stalactites, and sure enough, they've got bacteria in them. And what we can tell is you can see from the different layers of the stalactite, the lake forming and then sealing off and then disgorging. And it turns out the disgorging, which is when all the water comes shooting out of it underneath the ice sheet, is caused by geothermal activity. You know, Mount Erebus and stuff. You forget that Antarctica's got volcanic activity. It's happening under the ice, so you can't see it. So all the climate modellers know this is happening and know it's important, because if you melt the water under the ice, it acts as a lubricant. It goes out underneath the ice sheets, and the ice sheets all start skating down their glaciers because they're suddenly lubricated. So we're using bacteria in a stalactite under a lake to work out through time what has been happening with these ice sheets in terms of the geothermal activity happening, and that changes the bacteria, and then they ended up in the stalactites, and we can see exactly when the geothermal is happening. The ice is then shooting out to sea and melting and changing the currents around Antarctica, which are then affecting global climate. And so we're suddenly starting to look at how the climate has shifted, how the glacial maximum occurred, how things have happened all over the place using the stalactites. And I want to check it by measuring the small microorganisms that are in the sea around Antarctica that have been blown onto the ice. I want to see through time how they've changed in response to what we're seeing with the stalactites. So basically we're getting into global climate change now as well. So
you're completely cross-disciplinary,
yes,
aren't you?
Yes. I can't say no.
Necessary now?
No.
Or is it just because you're hyperactive?
I think it's a very short concentration span. I think that's what it comes down to. But it is a disadvantage. In the modern world, scientists really expected to do one thing, you know, the whole KPI thing. You know, you've got that one target and that's what you're working towards. And the kind of stuff that we do is very old-fashioned. You don't tend to find so many people doing such bizarre stuff.
It's quite Victorian, isn't it?
It is, but it's great. I mean, you come across stuff, you go way out of your... I don't know anything about climate change. I'm having to make it up as I go along to, you know, talk to... But what you do is you go to these experts and you say, I've got this data. You know what it means. Let's work together. I'll get you more data if you tell me how to interpret it, or you
interpret
it.
And that's even more possible now because of the internet.
Exactly. Exactly.
So you can have all sorts of networks of people who don't know very much about something, but they know somebody who does.
Exactly. And that's the kind of thing that I think this investigator-led funding should be encouraging. That's not a small group in a centre somewhere that's been put together because they all work on diabetes. It's this kind of networking. I think you're exactly right. The power that we've created through the internet and communication should be such that scientists and completely unrelated groups all over the world can suddenly start working together in ways that were never possible before, which are hugely synergistic. And that's not happening that much. It's happening a bit, but the funding agencies are slow to kind of... It's very hard to imagine. You know, it's like a neural network. How
and
are you
hard
gonna plan
to
that?
Keep control of.
Exactly. And so that's where I still think the record... If someone's got a good record of doing this, they're likely to keep doing it. So give them money if they've got a great idea, and check in 3 or 4 years. But that's the key point. In 3 or 4 years, not at the end of this week and the end of next week and the end of the week after that.
That's Professor Alan Cooper, the New Zealander who directs the Australian Centre for Ancient DNA at the University of Adelaide.